Local news, culture, and NPR.
From Radio Catskills Studios in Liberty, New York, this is the local edition. I'm Jason Dole. Thank you so much for being here with me. Coming up, it's a Thursday evening. That's when we check in with Philip Pantuso, the Times Union Hudson Valley, for the latest news. We'll be doing that in just a moment, starting with news about housing in the Hudson Valley. And if you've been following along, developments in housing in Hudson Valley are important to follow because they often set precedent for the rest of New York State. So Philip will be joining us in just a moment. But first, we start with news from Albany, because a new school year marks the beginning of a statewide ban on smartphones and certain electronics. As Noel Evans with the New York Public News Network tells us, the state just dropped a new database of over 1,000 schools' distraction-free plans.
In a statement, Governor Kathy Hochul says the new online resource makes it easier for parents and students to review their school's plan ahead of time. And that ahead of the school year, communication around the policies is key. Districts had until the beginning of this month to post their plans for keeping students detached from phones, smartwatches, and the like. That includes plans for how devices will be stored throughout the day so that no student can access them unsupervised, and how exemptions to the rule will be addressed, including for students with specific needs and for emergency situations. Hochul says that 96% of districts have published their plans. For those that haven't, the governor's office says the state's online resource will be updated to reflect changes when any additional school policies are published and submitted. That information is available at ny.gov/phone-free, and it includes local school districts' phone-free policies. In Rochester, I'm Noel Evans for the New York Public News Network.
And thank you, Noel. Well, now on the local edition, it is a Thursday. That's when we usually check in with Philip Pantuso, Times Union. And Philip is here for us to check in with. And as I understand it, Philip, you've got some breaking news.
I do, yeah. So today, the Public Service Commission approved rate hikes for two utility companies, actually, that have been seeking them. National Grid, a little further upstate and more relevant to our area, Central Hudson. So both of these were three-year rate hikes that the utility says it needs for a whole host of reasons to comply with state climate laws, to prevent service outages, to replace outdated infrastructure, to guard against cybersecurity threats, and perhaps most importantly, to upgrade some of its outdated utility infrastructure and increase the power it's able to provide. So what I mean here by rate hike basically is that Central Hudson got permission from the state regulatory agency that approves these things to charge customers more for the electricity and the natural gas it's delivering. What that will look like is the average electric customer's bill is going to go up about 3% or about $5.43 per month over the first year. And the average natural gas bill will go up about 5% or $7.73 per month for the first year. Those hikes will continue through 2027, eventually hitting about 10% increase from now for electric delivery and close to 20% for natural gas. And these take effect on September 1st, so in just about 2 weeks.
Now, this news can't be separated from what people might remember Central Hudson the most for around here is that they were in the news a lot for a couple of years there because of serious billing issues with their customers, issues that were so serious it actually led to a shakeup in management of Central Hudson. And there were people that did not want to see this rate hike. What are they saying today?
I would say probably the only people who wanted to see this rate hike were Central Hudson and perhaps their parent company, the Canadian multinational company Fortis. I have rarely seen a story get such immediate criticism or a topic get such immediate and bipartisan criticism across the board. Kind of the minute this decision came out, my inbox started flooding with statements from local elected officials, all the way to congressional members like Josh Riley and even Governor Kathy Hochul, who said that while she was happy that the Public Service Commission was able to kind of lower the initial rate asks, which were even higher, she still said that this is basically not acceptable. But yeah, I would say that the statements range from critical to outraged. Probably the strongest words came from City Assemblymember Sarah Hanna-Shrestha, who called, who not only criticized Central Hudson, but said that the whole process through which these rate hikes are sought and approved is a sham for customers. It's worth noting, of course, that Shrestha, along with Michelle Hinchey in the state Senate, sponsor a bill that would permit a public takeover of Central Hudson, so such that it would be, you know, a publicly owned utility company and not really be able to seek profits to the degree that it has been. Congressmember Josh Riley noted that the day before Central Hudson officially asked for this increase last year, members of Fortis, its parent company, had touted that they were seeking, or that they had seen millions of dollars, in quarterly profits. So, yeah, you know, Central Hudson is, as you noted, they have been in the news for tons of reasons, mostly, really, almost all bad ones in the last couple of years, and they have clean house, and they say that they have fixed their billing system. Certainly, you don't hear about as many billing irregularities now as you did a few years ago, but you know, the timing on their part really couldn't have been worse, because they've just dealt with quite a fire hose of bad PR for a few years now.
Yeah, well, even this breaking news that we're starting with about this rate hike, you're putting this out in conjunction with another kind of negative news story for Central Hudson. The headline is that they're admitting regulatory violation in the Wappingers Falls gas explosion.
Yeah, so folks may remember this. I can't remember if I talked about it at the time, but a couple of years ago in November of 2023, there was a gas explosion that injured 15 people, sent 8 people to the hospital in Wappingers Falls. This happened when a contractor who was doing a project to replace service lines with plastic lines struck an active natural gas line, and it basically caused the building to blow up. And the fallout of that has been really devastating. There, Maria Silva, who's done all of the reporting on this for us, has talked to the family that was most badly hurt by this explosion, the ones who actually lived in the house. And there's a young boy there who was so badly injured that he essentially has to live in a climate-controlled environment for the rest of his life because his skin is so badly burned and flaking. And he still has to be in the hospital, you know, almost 2 years later, he's still in the hospital 5 days a week. So, you know, naturally when this kind of thing happens, the state investigated. And what they determined basically was that in the sort of project binder that Central Hudson gave to the contractor who was conducting this work, this natural gas line was not denoted on the maps. And furthermore, there were other documentation that they were able to turn up that showed that Central Hudson knew that this was there. They had older maps with this line on it. So it's not really clear why it wasn't included in the materials that they gave to the contractor. They must have thought that it was no longer active. So that began this separate case before the Public Service Commission, where Central Hudson has kind of throughout until today, apparently, been denying any formal responsibility. But today they reversed course as part of a settlement that ends this case. And they admitted that they broke a public service law, basically that requires utility companies to, quote, provide safe and adequate service, essentially admitting that they failed to do so by not marking this line. They're going to pay a $5 million penalty and also establish a separate fund that they're calling the Gas Safety Protocol Remediation Fund, which is going to pay for targeted safety measure enhancements to prevent similar incidents in the future. They also said that these costs will not be passed on to customers, which is, I guess, an easier thing to say on a day when you're passing on separate costs to customers. So that's the Central Hudson news of today. Active day for them at the Public Service Commissions.
Right. We're talking to Philip Pantuso, Times Union, Hudson Valley, and that was the breaking news. Two stories just came out today, both involving Central Hudson, which is something we've discussed a lot here over the last couple of years on air. Something else that we've discussed a lot, Philip, is housing issues, housing concerns in our region, and specifically housing regulation that originates in the Hudson Valley, because it often sets precedent for the rest of the state and sometimes beyond. And you've got a development there as well in the housing issue today.
That's right. So Kingston, which was the first upstate city to adopt the state's rent stabilization law when that was expanded to all municipalities, now may no longer qualify for that law. So this law, people have probably heard about it. It's the Emergency Tenant Protection Act. And basically what it does is, if your city has what's called a housing emergency, then you can form a rent guidelines board that will set rents in protected buildings. So these buildings, just to sort of make this quick, are only buildings that were built before 1974 and contain six or more units. To opt into the law, you have to have what's called a housing emergency. And the only way to show that currently is by showing that the vacancy rate in those buildings is 5% or lower. When Kingston first adopted the law back in 2022, they had a vacancy rate that was below 5%. You know, a thing I've talked about a lot on the show is that mechanism, the vacancy study, has come in for a lot of criticism, both by supporters and opponents of the law. It's really hard to conduct these kinds of studies, particularly on the scale you need to actually demonstrate, a quote-unquote housing emergency. And, they have been subject to lawsuits really in every municipality where they have been attempted, including Kingston's. Like, just 2 months ago, the legal battle over Kingston's 2022 survey finally ended at the State Court of Appeals. But when Kingston passed its law 3 years ago, it also committed itself to doing a new vacancy study every 3 years in an attempt, futile in the end, to ward off legal challenges. And so this is a little bit of an own goal on their part, because they did not have to do another vacancy study this soon. That's part of the law that they passed, and so they did. And it showed that their vacancy rate in those buildings was now above 7%. So that means it does not qualify. And it's not exactly clear what that will mean for rent stabilization in the city. As far as I can tell, there has never been a city that has adopted rent stabilization or any form of rent control and then shed it. So it's a bit of a novel situation right now. I was told by the city's director of housing initiatives that the way the law is written will permit carve-outs for certain classes of buildings. So, for example, in Kingston's survey, looked at a representative sampling of all the buildings that would be subject to rent control. And while the overall vacancy rate in all those buildings is above the qualifying threshold, in the largest buildings, the ones that have like 20 or more units, it's actually below the threshold. And so apparently the city's common council can still invoke rent stabilization for those buildings. But all of this is going to have to go over to the city council, and they're going to make decisions about it at their next meeting.
Right. And I understand that we don't know exactly what this means and what might happen next, but I'm just wondering if you could just speculate a little bit on, you know, two possible interpretations of this for at least, you know, renters in terms of like good news or bad news, because on one side, this seems like these are signs that, well, these laws have worked, these changes have worked. But looking at it broadly, then like an initial concern as you look at this, well, geez, if you can't keep enforcing those laws, then won't you just recreate the same conditions that led to the housing crisis? Are either of those takes touching on reality, or are they both too broad to be applicable?
No, I really think you're touching on something there. I mean, it's worth noting that since Kingston adopted rent control, they've also passed a number of other policies that are designed to be tenant-friendly, including good cause eviction. They've limited the number of short-term rentals like Airbnbs, and they implemented a comprehensive zoning reform that allows for infill development, more mixed-use development, and just more housing development overall. And, you know, as part of the release of this of these results, the mayor said that Kingston currently has more than 600 units of housing in its development pipeline, which is the most since the 1970s. And, you know, a thing I've said a lot when we've talked about housing in the past is that the structural problem here is that due to zoning and environmental regulations and a whole host of other sort of bureaucratic and red tape and other hurdles to jump through, the main problem with housing in upstate New York is that we just have not been building enough of it. And there, you know, there are good reasons for that, right? Like those environmental laws exist for a reason. And, you know, for most of this region in recent decades, we have been losing population. But obviously, you know, most of this region is now in a pretty severe housing crisis, but it still includes Kingston. You know, this report noted that, since 2016, the median home values in Ulster County, of which Kingston is the biggest city, have tripled, and that median rents have nearly doubled. And more than half of Kingston renters are cost burden, which means they spend about a third or more of their income on rent. So, yeah, on the one hand, you could say maybe this is working because the number's ticking in the right direction. On the other, like if you remove the mechanism that's causing it to work, are we just going to backslide right back into the situation that got us here in the first place?
And at the same time, you're looking at other reports that are indicating that the housing affordability crisis is actually worsening, right?
That's right. Yeah. So last week there were two reports that painted a sort of damning picture of that crisis. The first was a poll of about 1,000 New York residents by two progressive groups, Housing Justice for All and Data for Progress. That poll found that housing costs are forcing many residents in the Hudson Valley to cut back on groceries and healthcare. And more than a third of them said that overall costs, specifically with regards to housing, had them considering leaving the state within the past year. And then there was a separate report released by Hudson Valley Pattern for Progress, which is a think tank. This is their annual report called Out of Reach, which looks at a whole host of housing and wage data across the Hudson Valley and Catskills. And what that found was that the cost of housing has continued to outpace wages, especially for lower income earners. That means now that a single adult working 40 hours per week on average wages cannot afford even a one-bedroom apartment in any of the nine counties that they looked at, from Westchester up to Greene and out to Sullivan, without spending more than a third of their income on housing, which is, you know, considered to be the cutoff for affordability. So, yeah, really, really, really damning numbers in that report.
Are there any reactions to those reports from lawmakers or advocates, or are they still so new enough that it'll take some time before those folks start, you know, leveraging this information publicly?
The Pattern for Progress report especially is, in my opinion, the kind of gold standard for housing and wage data in the Hudson Valley. It has informed a lot of what counties and cities in the Hudson Valley do in terms of crafting policy. We've seen a couple of statements in reaction to these reports, but nothing sort of concrete yet. Certainly, I think, it's just going to put housing back at the top of the list, particularly for the state lawmakers when they're back in session next year. Kathy Hochul's made housing a big priority, and there have been some, gains on that front on tenant protections. I'm going to imagine that a law that that the aforementioned Assembly Member Sarah Hanna Shrestha sponsors that would change the mechanism for rent stabilization and give smaller and more rural communities way more options for adopting it. I'm going to guess that will be a big priority for at least the progressive wing of Democrats next year in Albany.
This is the Local Edition. I'm Jason Dole, and I'm talking with Philip Pantuso, Times Union, Hudson Valley. This is an interesting headline, but you're saying that a historic black church in Washington, D.C. is suing a Hudson Valley chapter of the Proud Boys.
That's right. This is a really interesting story, actually. The Metropolitan African Methodist Episcopal Church in D.C., about 6 months ago, was awarded the trademark to the Proud Boys. Just the name, the branding, all of it. And that was because back in December 2020, a chapter of the Proud Boys down in D.C. burned a Black Lives Matter banner and vandalized the church, which is a historic black church. It was founded in 1838. It has hosted the funerals of Frederick Douglass and Rosa Parks, among other civil rights icons. Proud Boys vandalized the church. That led to a lawsuit, and the Proud Boys lost that lawsuit. They were supposed to pay damages as a result of that, but they never did. They owed the church $2.8 million, almost all of which is still to be paid. So to try to collect on the judgment, the church went after the trademark rights to the Proud Boys, which I thought this was pretty funny. In the judge's decision awarding the trademark, he wrote that that was the Proud Boys' only known valuable asset. So that's how you have this historic black church in Washington, D.C., owning the copyright to the term Proud Boys. That has not stopped some local chapters of the Proud Boys from continuing to not only use that term, but sell merchandise and make money off the back of it, including the Hudson Valley chapter of the Proud Boys. So the D.C. church sued them, and their leader, William Pepe, who was part of the January 6th riot, in federal court this past week, saying that they have to stop doing that, and that they have to pay all royalties that the Hudson Valley chapter has made on any merchandise sales bearing the Proud Boys trademark.
Wow. And do you happen to know, was this part of a bunch of lawsuits that this church was doing at once, since this seems to be their way to interact with Proud Boy groups around the country? Or is this just one in a series?
I had that exact same question, and we do not know. The lawyers for that church didn't get back to us on that exact question. I did search federal court records, which are pretty easy to search, and this was the only active case in which this church was a plaintiff. So it seems to be the only one that's active, at least, but certainly the Hudson Valley chapter is not the only Proud Boys chapter that still call themselves the Proud Boys. So if this is the only one going on right now, I expect it won't be for much longer.
Any direct reaction from the local Proud Boys?
They did not respond to a request for comment as well.
Okay. And now we've got about 3 minutes left. Do you want to talk about vaccinations in New York State?
Yeah, more more data here. New data from the CDC shows that New York State has the second highest vaccination rate among kindergartners in the country, just a little bit behind California. And why this is interesting, I think, is because this is coming as other states are seeing a big spike in vaccine refusal. There are 19 states where more than 10% of kindergartners are not fully vaccinated. Top in the list is Idaho. 21% of kindergartners there arrived last fall without all of their vaccinations. In New York, it's only 0.3%. And that's because New York is one of only a handful of states, I believe five, that has basically no non-medical exemptions to vaccination. The most prominent of these, of course, was the religious exemption, which New York State banned in 2019. At that time, there were more than 26,000 children in public and private schools who were not vaccinated with specifically that exemption. The most recent number, I think there were only 630 kindergartners across New York State last fall that did not have their full suite of vaccination. So that's a little bit of good news, at least if you believe in the science behind vaccinations.
And is, you're saying that these numbers perhaps reflect some of these regulations in New York State? Is that how it appears to you?
Yeah, absolutely. The vaccination rate among kindergartners in New York has gone way, way, way up since New York banned the religious exemption. From more than 26,000 back then to only 600 now. Mm. And I can't remember where New York ranked at the time, but the states that do not have, or the states that have no non-medical exemptions to vaccination are all the states that rank highest nationally in vaccination rate, which shows that, like, for better or worse, there are parents using exemptions liberally in other states
and
prevent their kids
from
getting vaccinated.
Another contrast you can draw. Okay. And finally, real quick before we go, I don't know if it was the last time we spoke or the time before that, because time is fleeting and hard to keep track of, but you brought us a story of the Hudson Valley film commissioner who did a lot of work to get film production into upstate New York, passed away rather unexpectedly. And we were asking, what does that mean for the future of film productions in upstate New York? And you've got a little bit of an update on that, right?
Yeah, I did not know at the time, but basically as we were speaking, they were in the process of announcing the new director of the Hudson Valley Film Commission, a woman named Stacey Cormier Major. She replaces the late Laurent Rejo, who died a couple weeks ago now. Stacey has had like a 15-year career in the film industry. She's part of the Directors Guild of America and has worked on a number of shows, including Boardwalk Empire, Saturday Night Live, and alongside filmmakers like Steven Spielberg, Martin Scorsese, and Jim Jarmusch. She's lived in Kingston since 2020, apparently, and will be filling the mighty shoes of Laurent Rejo, and I'm excited to see where she takes the commission.
All right. Well, thank you for bringing us all of this news. All of these stories, of course, are up now at timesunion.com. We've been talking to Philip Antuso, Times Union Hudson Valley. Philip, thank you so much.
You got it. Take care.
Well, that's it for the local edition. I'm Jason Dole. Thank you so much for being here with me tonight. Do not miss Radio Chatskill tomorrow morning at 10. Tim Bruno, where we conclude our week of Woodstock anniversary local news coverage with a special report on the current state of camping on the original Woodstock site at Bethel Woods with Donna Fellenberg of Catskill Character and Valerie Mancy, culture reporter for Radio Chatskill. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 10. And for all of our Woodstock coverage, check out our brand new podcast page at WJFFradio.org, Woodstock Lost and Found. Woodstock Lost and Found at WJFFradio.org. Everything that we're doing about Woodstock is going to be right there. Stay with us for more news from the Daily next. This is Radio Catskill.
I'm Jeff. Join me Saturday at midnight for Electric Mountain. 2 hours of house, techno, indie dance, and more, plus sets by top local, New York City, and global guest DJs. From the underground to the highest peak, it's Electric Mountain, Saturday at midnight on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville. This is Radio Catskill. Local news, culture, and NPR.